return to Palestine. What we saw in Jenin gives us hope that liberation is near.
We've become used to their crimes. They bargained that the old generation is gone, but they were stunned how the new generation is even more steadfast and courageous and ready to face them.
After 2 days of Israeli attacks on Jenin, at least 12 Palestinians were killed and dozens more were injured.
The United Nations says it is alarmed at the scale of Israel's assault on Jenin, yet people of Lebanon and Palestine who have witnessed firsthand decades of Israeli atrocities say there is nothing alarming about the aggression. However, they all have a collective conviction that the resistance will turn victorious. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Out of the classrooms and under the streets, hundreds of thousands of school teachers here and across England on strike for 48 hours this week in what's become a battle for dignity and better wages.
We want to be with our children. We really do. You know, it's coming towards the end of term. We want to enjoy every day with them. But at the same time, we recognise that the fight for children's future has to involve strike action because this government doesn't listen.
There are others who are listening. Parents and students.
These strikes have to happen. Obviously, they're impacting in the short term, but with extra pay, teachers will be more motivated and they can help in the long run rather than them withering out.
And withering out they are. Underfunded and overworked, the teachers are not just striking, they're leaving the profession. Gillian Keegan, who runs the Department of Education, says the government has made a fair and reasonable pay offer to teachers. Yet her department has refused to publish recommendations for allegedly a higher pay offer by the Independent School Teachers Review Body, a decision that unions say risks dragging out the current dispute.
Part of the argument here is how a pay rise should be paid for. The government says schools should use their existing budgets to fund any pay increases. But the teachers have been pushing back, saying the school budgets are already stretched and that any wage rise should be fully funded by the government.
And it's not just the teachers' unions who aren't being heard. Also, workers across the public sector, such as transport and health, who have supported each other over the months. Solidarity that has scared the government into responding with a set of draconian laws to make it difficult for strikes to take place. In an atmosphere of uncertainty and with inflation still high, the strikers here are defiant, saying they will push ahead with industrial action until their demands are met. Said Bourza, London.
The burning of the Holy Quran in Sweden has ignited a protest in the capital Sana'a, where U.S. and Israeli flags were set on fire in the streets. Protesters also denounced the latest military operations by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Members of the Palestinian-based Islamic Jihad resistance movement also attended the rally. They called on the Muslim world to unite and counter the Israeli occupying forces.
We came out to tell the world that we are with Palestinians and with Jenin refugee camp, and we are ready to support them. We in Yemen are ready to go to war with the Israeli enemy, who only seems to understand the language of war and violence.
We came out today to call on the Muslim world to defend the Holy Quran and to support the Palestinian cause, which is the Muslim cause. This is an obligation for Muslims to strive and revive and unite against the enemies of Allah.
Some observers believe Israelis, along with the West, have a hand in promoting those who insult Islam.
The individuals who burned the Holy Quran or who insulted Islam represent the aspirations and stance of the West, which promotes the burning of Quran and protects those who engage in such activities even on the Eid holiday. This is done just to insult Muslims worldwide. We will no longer stay silent.
Many Yemeni protesters we spoke with expressed their willingness to go to war with the Israeli regime and any state that supports insulting Muslims' holy book or occupying Muslim holy lands.
Israeli officials say the military operations in Jenin aim to strike what they call a terrorist hub in the occupied West Bank city. Now the protesters here say the Muslim world should become united against what they describe the terrorist Israeli regime. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Muslims in Afghanistan celebrate Eid al-Ghadir with different ceremonies every year. This place in Kabul is only one of the hundreds where people have gathered to celebrate this day and share the joy together.
Today is the day that Islam came to perfection, because on this day back then, Prophet Muhammad raised Imam Ali's hands and said, Ali is my successor.
Today, these people who are followers of Imam Ali have gathered here to celebrate the joyous occasion by praising the Prophet and Imam Ali.
This Eid marks the day that Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib as his successor by raising his hand and saying to the huge crowd who were following him on his last Hajj pilgrimage, "Whomever I am his leader, Ali is his leader."
Ali alayhi salam.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, is the source of justice, crier of justice, and symbol of justice, not only in Islamic community, but in human society. When you speak of justice, the name of Ali is there. We honor Imam Ali because we honor justice. Along with that, Ali was the most honest and a man of virtue.
Imam Ali is the first man who returned the call of Prophet Muhammad and embraced Islam. That is why his most famous nickname is Amir al-Mu'minin, that means the head of the believers.
The personality of Imam Ali has drawn much attention throughout history. Today might be an opportunity for everyone to know about the man who once said, "No wealth is like wisdom, and no indigence is like ignorance." Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Yemeni took to the streets of more than 10 provinces to honor Imam Ali and his revered household on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Qadir. Officials from Ansarullah resistance movement took part in the events, stating that Prophet Muhammad, some 1400 years ago, declared Imam Ali as his successor and an example for Muslims to follow and support.
Today, we the Muslim nation have a decision to make. Either we become a member of the party of Allah, who is victorious, or we become a member of the party of Satan, who will lose. Rest assured, our faith in Allah, our honorable spirits, our Islamic upbringing, and our Quranic knowledge rejects that we will ever become a member of the party of Satan.
During a televised speech, the leader of Ansarullah, Malik al-Houthi, congratulated the Muslim nation on the occasion, warning of anti-Muslim plots hatched by the United States and Israel.
In this day and age, we see the enemy uses all its huge resources to push an agenda to deform and degrade mankind so that they can remain slaves under its rule of oppression and its darkness. The rule of Allah, however, guides mankind from darkness to light. This is why the Zionist, American, and Western lobby is declaring a war on the Holy Quran. They want to continue their falsehood. They want to continue misleading people.
During the celebratory events, Yemenis also condemned the latest Israeli attack on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. They also slammed some Arab countries for maintaining ties with the Israeli regime.
Eid al-Ghadir is an annual event held in Yemen to highlight the significant role Imam Ali and his blessed household played in spreading the true message of Islam. Observers believe the West is declaring a war on that message, and the Muslim world should follow the examples of Imam Ali and defend Islam. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The world's largest Qadir celebration. In the Iranian capital of Tehran, a 10-kilometer route was lined with more than 1,200 stations to celebrate Eid al-Ghadir. The streets were decorated with green flags and other decorative elements as part of the celebrations.
The route was filled with people from all walks of life.
Millions of Iranians all across the country celebrate Eid al-Ghadir. People from all walks of life celebrate this day together out in the streets.
Today is Eid al-Ghadir, which is one of our biggest days. We have brought our children to get them familiar with the Eid al-Ghadir celebration. This is a happy day and good things are happening today. Our children should learn about Eid al-Ghadir from a young age.
Children are also a main part of the massive rally. They say they have joined the 10-kilometer walk for the love of Imam Ali. Families also take the opportunity of Eid al-Ghadir to introduce the teachings of Imam Ali to their children.
We are here because of our love for our supreme leader and Imam Ali. We love Iran and Imam Ali.
I want to know Imam Ali because he was a good man. We want our children to know about Imam Ali and follow his path.
Today I'm here with my daughter, Maryam, and my wife. I've brought my daughter here to mark Eid al-Ghadir together.
On this day, different programs and events such as musical performance and plays are carried out and food and drinks are distributed as a part of the massive celebration. The celebration ends with fireworks as a reminder of the brilliance of this significant day. Farzana Shuryun, Tehran.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we try to answer your questions and queries you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is an Islamic scholar and a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, Qom, Iran. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Well, we have been talking about technology and its impact on the teenage upbringing, and Professor Salman Nakavi has been helping us. Professor, what would you like to share with the parents today who are dealing with the teenagers in this tech world?
Yes, as we have been saying all along, that technology should be at the service of mankind. It should be for the benefit of mankind, not the other way around. Yes, we have doomsday scenarios where the machines are going to take over the world and everything. Human beings will be ruled by machines. I mean, it is a possibility, but it's a very remote possibility. It just goes to show to us and demonstrate to us that we need to stop this happening, if this
exactly.
could happen.
Again, the same thing, that the tools that we created, we should not become tools of those tools.
Exactly. I mean, there should be some moral authority, and there should be some moral requirements which stop us using technology in a way which is going to be reprehensible, which is going to be something which is going to end up in a very wrong way. For example, now when we're talking about cloning or genetical engineering, so there's great advancement in this. And stem cells research is going on in many places, like in the Islamic Republic of Iran. They're also progressing quite extensively in this field.
Swiftly, yeah.
And these are one of the cutting edge technologies that are in vogue today in the world.
Yeah.
Now, so it's for treatment of many diseases. This is going to help us.
Yeah.
For example, even infertility can be taken care of by this research. Or, for example, even many children who are going to be born into this world with defects, natural defects, maybe that can also be somehow
cured
or prevented or whatever. Even maybe tomorrow you could be able to select what gender of child you want. Maybe that would be possible. But there are some limits to it. I mean, tomorrow genetical engineering can come up with a monster, a human being and a technological monster. So this is possible. It is within the possibility of mankind to do this, but it is morally wrong. It is something which is going to take us to a disaster.
Right.
So technology has to advance, has to progress, but within limits, within moral limits, within ideological limits. What is allowed, what is not allowed, has to be taken care of. For example, when we talk about the nuclear bomb, atomic bomb, now there's no doubt about it that nuclear technology is very important for mankind. Our children nowadays know about it. Nuclear technology helps in medicine, helps in agriculture, it helps us in generating energy. So tomorrow our children should know it and know that it is going to, these are one of the fields that they can go into. But then again, the nuclear bomb, the hydrogen bomb, the plutonium bomb, they are also the negative aspects that are not allowed. They are morally disallowed.
Right.
Therefore, we have this ruling and this fatwa of Imam Khamenei, who has very explicitly banned the production of weapons of mass destruction.
Right. So, Professor, we'll be discussing more with you after a short break. Now, listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. We have Professor Salman Naqvi with us, and we are discussing the impact of technology on teenage upbringing.
So this is I was discussing the moral aspects, the ideological aspects, the religious aspects of technology. We need to teach our children what's the good about it? What are the bads? What are the goods? The religious edicts about it, the limits which have to be taken care of. They should learn about it. So tomorrow, if they have been trained, if they have been educated, their upbringing has been based on moral principles, on religious principles.
Right.
Then certainly when they become into contact with this technology, whether it's for their personal benefit or it's for the benefit of other human beings. They employ it in their lives. They know what the limits are. They should know that. Otherwise, those people who created the nuclear bomb, if they had been educated morally, they would have resisted.
Right.
They would have resisted those the authorities who were making them, paying them to build that bomb.
Right.
So you can't say the scientist who was behind this theory, who discovered nuclear technology or the nuclear aspects or the potential in that field. But those who went to create that technology and created the weapons of mass destruction, they are those human beings who have not been educated morally. Yes, they are offered money, they are offered resources to carry out wrong things. So if our children are taught and educated, look, you're not supposed to do anything for the sake of money. Even if somebody gives you money, gives you a lot of wealth and a lot of money to build something which is destructive, to do something which is destructive, which is murderous, which is destroys mankind.
Right.
Then he or she should resist that.
Right.
And that temptation should be, stopped. It should be resisted. So this comes with proper upbringing. It
right.
comes from childhood. But if mm-hmm. child in the childhood, the proper upbringing is not there, a child becomes, he lives with anxiety, with stress, and his feelings and emotions are, they are suppressed, and he wants to do anything he likes in the future.
Right.
So the important thing for our parents is that they should be able to teach their children how to engage with this
technological world.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's really very important, because if we lose that track of recognizing what the problems our teenagers are facing while dealing with the tech, maybe it would be difficult then to cure that, because as soon as the disease is recognized, it could be cured at early. We'll discuss more with you, Professor, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we have Professor Salman Nakawi with us. Well, Professor, do we have any technology in itself? We have been discussing for several sessions now, it has positive impact, it has negative impact. But does it have any particular negative impact that parents really need to be concerned about?
Yeah, I think anything that you get addicted to and it becomes a habit, and you can't cannot change that habit. That's the difficult thing, especially. We all of us, for example, when there's a phone, Android phone or a smartphone in front of us, we're prone. We become habituated to, all the time we lift it up and we want to, to fiddle with it, to do something, to open this application or that application.
We suffer from fear of missing out.
Yes, so we need to continuously open it and look at it and find, and we're, but thereby we are becoming addicted to it. So
right.
Our children, they become addicted to it much more than us.
Right.
And they need to. today, even grown-up people, they have find problems. When we're talking to each other, we're looking at the phone and we're not looking and paying attention to what's
being... So this digital addiction is some of one thing that parents need to be taking care of.
Parents need to lead by example, that when they're talking, for example, especially when you're in a meeting, when you're going to a gathering, you're going to a social event, then the best thing would be that the rules that should be made in the house, in that gathering, that phone's off, please. Let's turn off our phones, or let's keep our phones outside.
Yeah.
Outside, let's keep a place in the house where all our phones are put. And we say, okay, within this 2 or 3 hours.
Like as we have here in the exercises or swimming sessions, you're not allowed to take phone from the very initial point you enter
exactly.
These halls of exercises or gyms or even the swimming pools. You really are not allowed to take your phones with you. So that's really a big moment. Like I personally have this experience that you, when you are there without phone, you really kind of think about yourself. You have more self-awareness. You get to know more about yourself, who I am, and you come out of that digital addiction.
Exactly. So you need to, one thing is doing it by making rules and enforcing it by, for example, you're going to a meeting and nowadays these gadgets, they become through this phone tapping is going on. Even if you're not using the phone, this gadget can be used as an eavesdropper. People can, come and they can... listen to what you're saying.
So exactly.
Insensitive, when you're talking about sensitive issues, even family issues, it would be much recommended that this phone is kept out of it, because
right.
Anybody can hack your phone and come to become a participant in your
right.
discussion. So
right.
These are the downsides. So you need to enforce principles and rules to you somehow get rid of this. Secondly, you need to learn self-restraint and teach your children to develop this self-restraint. For example, sometimes every time we pass the fridge, we want to open it up and find something in it and pick it up and eat it.
Eat something.
So that temptation is there, even in elders. So how do we, stop that habit? Stop that happening, that we're nimbling all the time, eating something here and there, and that's going to make us fat, for example. So we need to, for example, regulate our times for eating. We're not going to eat between these times, for example.
Right.
And secondly, even when we're tempted to open the fridge and our hands are moving towards something which we find sumptuous and we want to drink it or eat it,
right.
The moment our hand is going, we should stop ourselves
okay.
and close the fridge. So if we do that, we can learn how to, remove these bad habits. And the same goes with the phone. We stop ourselves. If we are tempted to go and pick up the phone and so, immediately we should put it down.
Right, right. So, and so goes right with the digital tech, which has many positive impacts. But at the same time, if it leads to an addiction, it could negatively impact the teenager's physical and mental upbringing, his academic performance, and can actually interfere in the sleep patterns and also reduce the amount of time that he spends in exercising and outdoor activities. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This one lay.
Doing us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Dozens of marches against police violence in France have kicked off
after authorities banned a memorial rally for Adama Traoré. He's a young black man who died in police custody 7 years ago, with clashes reported in Paris in which his brother was actually arrested rather violently. This on top of the shock announcement that the country's police forces may be allowed to spy on suspects by remotely activating their camera, microphone, and GPS of their phones and other devices. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether France is going through a social crisis, or is it going through a democracy crisis, or is it on the cusp of a major uprising with police violence against people of color being the spark. First, let me introduce our guests. Matthew Everett, senior fellow at the American University in Moscow, joins us from Montreal. Also joining us, John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Over to our guests in Montreal first. Looking at Matthew Everett, a simple question that I'm going to start this program with. Is there systemic racism by French security forces?
Though the answer is a lot more complex and nuanced, yes, I think there actually is systemic racism in the case of France and in the case of many of the Western colonial societies that have a lot of unresolved baggage that has never been properly dealt with in their past, which in some ways that karma is coming up to bite a lot of current people within the French establishment. We see it all over the transatlantic. But yes, to answer your question, there is.
Okay. Taking into account the fact that you had 5 days of violence that occurred in many French cities, police violence was exercised against many French. And interestingly enough, in this video, the person who got arrested was the brother of Adam Traoré, who's that young black man who died in police custody 7 years ago. So when you see that, what are your thoughts in terms of police violence, again, coming off the heels of these 5 days of protests?
Well, I have to say that this is a very, very personal topic for myself. This, what's happening in Paris, is not, of course, confined only to France. This is there's a worldwide number of experiences of police violence. We've heard of the George Floyd case in the United States. And I myself left my native country of Canada after I testified in 1987 against two police who almost killed a man in front of me in Montreal, where I was studying, where your other guest tonight is speaking to us from. I had to leave Canada because I testified against the police and they were convicted and went to jail. That was my case. I can tell you this case is far worse. This man was killed, and now we have another man killed in these riots in France. And what the tragedy was compounded by the fact in France that no one was convicted of any crime in the case of Adama Traoré. No one was convicted even of brutality, let alone of murder. And these kinds of flashpoints prove that the police, at least the minority of violent and out-of-control police, are abusing their power and threatening the system more so than peaceful demonstrators. And these marches in memory of Adama Traoré in France have been conducted since 2016, when he was killed, until this year, 7 years with no violence whatsoever. And the government's intervention to lock down and ban these demonstrations today is indicative of the government's fear of their own people.
You know, when you have the UN weigh in on this, in particular the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, there, Matthew Ehret, they have asked France to actually pass legislation that defines bans racial profiling. They've requested that from France. And the other area that is interesting is what I believe it hits it in the right on the spot is how they said they were concerned by the persistent practice of racial profiling combined with excessive use of force in the application of law, in particular by the police, against members of minority groups, notably people of African and Arab origin. Do you think the UN is defining this problem in a major way?
Well, I think it's always a bit of a danger to fall into certain myopic trappings of the sort of game that is being played in some sense, because there are always the issue of foreign intelligence agencies, mass manipulation and other things that try to focus the debate, the acceptable narrative in disputes around very controlled, factionalized discussions around the debate, whether it's uncontrolled immigration that are stealing our jobs and making our lives worse economically, or is it going to be just the reactionary conservative hand coming down violently, which in both cases there's elements of truth but also lies, because what's often being missed out, including from the UN in the discussion, is the matter of why did we bomb Libya? Why did France participate in so many regime change wars that have made the lives of people unlivable in North Africa and around Africa more generally, where France-Afrique has conducted an exploitative regime for decades and decades, if not centuries, which, again, has created a situation of ungovernability both in those countries but also in France and much of Europe itself. And, again, a lot of these discussions are too myopic for my tastes, and there are always involvements, like I've seen increasing evidence of various types of agents provocateurs who have been infused into the mix, as we've seen with many color revolutionary tactics all around the world. Even, you know, many white people, black, you know, dressed up in sort of like an Antifa type of militarist gear, conducting some of the worst acts of vandalism, even car bombs. There's evidence of weapons that seem to have been coming in from even Ukraine, flooding into the mob situation in France. So there's a bit of a controlled chaos that I think is bubbling up right now that is being influenced by forces that are not particularly involved with or representative of the people protesting or the authorities themselves. There's other factors, as seems to be the case.
Well, that's interesting. That puts another angle to this whole thing. Where do you think, what are the outside factors? Who would you attribute it to?
Well, I think that you have to look at the Anglo-American establishment, which has been very unhappy with some of the actions that have been taken by Macron. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of Macron, but Alex Craner, an analyst, has done some very good analysis on this, pointing out that Macron's recent trip from China, where he called just a few months ago for Europe not to be satraps of the United States foreign policy and came out with business deals involved with buying 64,000 metric tons of natural gas in Chinese yuan. He's made a request for France to be an involved member in the upcoming BRICS summit in South Africa, and even called NATO brain dead. He's made a point that, you know, Ukraine is just some far-off country. So the French elite, I think, recognized that they are rather disposable in a broader geopolitical gambit against Russia and China as the actual targets. And I think that France, there's sort of a bit of a faction fight amongst the elites between the French and the Anglo-American establishment.
Okay. Well, interesting. John Busnich, looking at the government response to this, in particular some government officials, there seems to be, if not there is, a disconnect. For example, when you take a look at what has been said in particular by, let me see, I have some sound bites here. Let's look at President Emmanuel Macron, the man at the top, who has denied institutional racism within the country's law enforcement agencies. Or you have the government spokesman who said the convening of demos in major cities that have not yet recovered from the rampages should not be done right now. Or you have another minister who said any ethnic profiling by law enforcement is banned in France. This is a ministry that has said that, adding the struggle against excess and racial profiling has intensified. In particular, when it comes to the French president, I guess, how could he come out and make a statement like that, that, you know, there is no racist police violence happening in his country?
Well, first of all, that's the job of the president in that system, to justify the system. That's what the president of France does. If there is a racial profiling, he's certainly not going to admit it unless a commission is formed and proves it. And for the president of France to admit that there's racial profiling in such a multi-ethnic city as Paris in particular would be a carte blanche for all kinds of uprisings and further violence. So Macron is in a tough place. Macron is coming from a bit, what is basically a right-of-center party, and he is trying to walk a narrow line between calming the demonstrators and at the same time protecting the system by denying what is evidently visible to many observers. Macron is also in a tough place on the international level, and this disruption in his home territory is limiting his ability to make any kind of impact with respect to the conflict in Ukraine and international affairs. So I would say that Macron is in a very unstable position, and he is trying to survive this summer. As we know, the French have rebellions and have revolutions in the summer. The storming of the Bastille was on the 14th of July. We're just days away from that. The anniversary, the day of the death of Adama Traoré was the 19th of July, and the march was held today, even though the police banned the march. France is on the cusp of what could turn into a real deposing of the president through public activity. The question is whether he is going to be able to control the police, because in many instances, the police in France have been far more harsh than their elected officials.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So taking a look at the way that the police has handled this, I mean, we have to cover this, Matthew, I heard. Are we looking at the fact that they've been giving too much power? Are we looking at them being told that they need to enforce the law in a harsh way when it comes to the protest? Or are we looking at other factors that are involved behind the behavior, which many have called excessive violence used on the protesters?
Well, there definitely is a lot of evidence of excessive reactions by many of the police in trying to put down the protest. It's difficult to say because it's such a complex moving piece with many, many parts to it. It's somewhat difficult to say exactly. I don't know how to answer that question exactly.
Okay.
What I could say is the following. Look, the French police have been... there's a lacking of leadership. There's lack of ability to just put some context and to communicate with the people, to own up to the sins of the past and the present, which would be very needed to begin to actually deal with the underlying rage and anger and sense of injustice in the masses. That's just not there right now. As the previous speaker just pointed out, there's been an effort to just ignore the reality and the pain that people are feeling. And at the same time, there's a bit of a two-facedness too, right? Where the previous protests that have really gripped France, the Yellow Vest movement, was ignored by the media or slandered as being radical right-wingers. But this particular protest now is being covered by the New York Times, being given a lot of focus because I think there are more political, geopolitical agendas that wish to destabilize France more than anything. And I think France, both the elites as well as the police officers, are falling into the trap by not by playing the game.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, we need to maybe change the direction of this program as to maybe cover some of the things that you are finding maybe hard to decipher here. Hopefully we'll get to that with a little bit of time that we got left. All right, so John Busnich, you know, taking a look at some of the things that have happened throughout the decades when it comes to France, it's no surprise to many what is happening right now because it seems like this has been something that has been passed on year after year, decade after decade, where the French overall, one administration after the other, has ignored the racist police violence. I mean, not only just the French government, you're talking about politicians, and just not Macron, that have denied institutional racism within the country. They don't believe it exists. But these are things that have bubbled on the surface. Where do you think the source of the problem is? Are we looking at the fact that there's certain areas in France in which the people who live in this underprivileged areas filled with migrants or people of color with African descent are not given the right economic opportunities like maybe the rest of the country has? What do you think?
That's of course correct. But I can tell you that there are entire districts in Paris which are considered at nighttime to be no-go zones. The police themselves hesitate to enter into those areas. And I think what one thing we haven't mentioned so far in this discussion today is the revelation to many people who've never believed it, although those of us in government advisory positions have known it all along, is that the police have the capacity to listen to your phone calls, to track your location, to access your files on your phone, and to see what's seen through the camera of your phone, and that the French government has admitted this, has blown the cover on the entire question of personal privacy and government spying. And I think that we've got a possibility here that you will see the racial-based unrest and the legitimate protests against police violence combined with the outrage of the rest of the population over the fact that they now realize through a government admission that they are being spied upon and watched 24/7 at the whim of the state. This is too much for the French. The French people are a revolutionary, democratically oriented nation. And once they get these two sticks in their hands, if they rub them against each other, the friction is going to rise, the fires are going to rise, and there is a real threat of instability in France. And this is exactly what NATO and the United States least want when they've got a war that they're pushing in Ukraine at the same time. This is the worst combination possible for the Western military police spying alliance.
All right, so that eliminates two factors, if you agree with him, John Ehret, of people that may be or entities that may be involved in what you said was foreign hands at play, for lack of a better way of me putting it. Because I think that's the kind of line that you are maybe more inclined to discuss, if I'm correct to understand you, John Ehret. Who's to gain from the unrest that's happening inside of France? And what would be their objectives?
Well, the issue of the broader Five Eyes and France being a sort of informal member of the Nine Eyes broader security apparatus, the Dragnet, that has been expanding its efforts since 1946, really, and growing in influence that interfaces with NATO. And I mean, there are unresolved issues like, you know, NATO's secret armies, the Operation Gladio operations that were used to conduct terrorist operations, both targeted assassinations as well as of nationalist leaders throughout the Cold War, as well as broader acts of terrorism in the 60s, 70s, 80s, that was always run by NATO, MI6, MI5, CIA operations. These are unresolved things that create an atmosphere strategy of tension and terror to have the populations who don't understand what the hell is going on half the time fall more into the embrace of their captured governments, who would be increasingly under the control of the same unresolved, unreconstructed Nazis and fascists that worked with the CIA at MI6, that ran many of the Central and Eastern European operations of NATO itself. You know, these were never dissolved. They were never this never disappeared, and I think it just took on a new form after the Soviet Union collapsed. So we have this issue now where you have two different orientations for the future that are pulling us, one being a multipolar view that is more protective of the idea of the sovereign nation state and cooperation, the other one based upon the idea of you know, fulfilling this type of global feudal society under a controlled master-slave structure. Uh-huh. And you have a battle within France over what role France is going to play in that process.
All right. Last question that I'm going to ask here is the notion of democracy, John Busnish, which many French are now under the illusion that that's what is actually being lost here. It was very evident when you had Emmanuel Macron fast-track the legislation when it came to the retirement age being raised by a couple of years. And, of course, you mentioned the government admission in terms of the control that they have regarding their phones, regarding their cameras, et cetera, and also the fact that Emmanuel Macron was actually contemplating restriction of social media. Are we looking at democracy under threat in France?
Absolutely. You put your finger right on it. And I first want to underline that I support every word of our other guest here today. He's right on the mark. This is a crisis of credibility of not just France, but of the so-called Western democratic system. We have seen the curtain pulled back. We have seen that the Wizard of Oz is an evil wizard and that he is running the system. And these are the oligarchs, the military-industrial complex, and the innocent black victims on the street are one, just one of the many victims of the entire system. It's a snake's nest, and it's exposed to public view, and the public is not putting up with it. And the people of France are the kind of people who will stand up and bring down a government. This is the key touch point right now in the stability of the entire Western alliance, and it's in Paris, and it's at a really critical hot point today.
Thank you very much, John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst. And thank you for your input there, Matthew. I heard very interesting. Senior fellow at the American University in Moscow spoke to us from Montreal. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,830